cold fear. The fear of the murderer disposing of the body, which would give deadly...
I laid the carpet in the backyard and threw about 20 or 30 buckets of water on it to try to wash the blood off. And the colour of the water that came off was like blood.
Next thing I remember was something scratching and pulling at my mouth. I opened my eyes, and Jean was lying there under me, and I had my hands around her throat.
Murder Most Foul. Six classic murder cases presented by Nick Ross. Case 2, Cabin 126.
What are we making?
Just under 18 knots, sir. 17.9 to be precise, sir.
Good. That should keep the old man happy. I'll just log it. Temperature?
81 degrees, sir.
Well, not too bad for the tropics. And at least there's a breeze. Heard some of the passengers were thinking of having a midnight bathe in the pool. Who's there?
Murray, sir. Night watchman reporting.
Oh, yes. Murray. Quiet night, eh?
More or less, sir. Except one thing. We got a call at 0258 this morning from one of the first-class cabins, number 126.
Who's that?
Miss Gibson, the actress.
Oh, yes, pretty girl. What the devil did she want at that time of night?
Well, it was a funny thing, son. When we checked, both the red and green lights were on. She'd rung for both steward and stewardess. Anyway, I sent Steer down. He's my assistant.
Well, not ill, was she?
The thing was, sir, when he got there, he went to open the door and... well, sir, it seems, there was a man in there.
Really? Well, nothing we can do about it, is there? Not for us to interfere with the passengers' morals. I'll make a confidential note of it anyway. Thanks, Murray.
The ship is the Durban Castle, 90 miles out to sea off the coast of Africa, en route between Cape Town and Southampton. The date, October the 18th, 1947. Next morning, when the stewardess comes to give Miss Gibson her morning call, she's surprised to find the cabin is unlocked. She notices the young actress's pyjamas and dressing gown are missing, and assumes she's gone for her bath. She tidies up the room generally and makes the bed. It's a little more disarranged than usual, and there are a few small stains on the pillow and sheet, but nothing to worry about. The porthole is open, but that's usual in the tropics. Miss Gibson doesn't return, though, and the stewardess eventually gets concerned and goes to find the bathroom steward.
Bill? Bill?
What's up, Eileen?
It's Miss Gibson in 126. When I went to wake her up, her cabin was unlocked.
So what? They're supposed to be, aren't they?
Yeah, but she always locks hers. I warned her about it. Told her it was a fire risk and what have you. But she would insist on locking it. Said she was nervous. Anyhow, when I went in, she wasn't there. I thought she might have gone for her bath. You haven't seen her, have you?
No, I haven't. I'd have noticed her if she'd been by. Very easy on the eye, that one.
That's funny. She's probably around somewhere. But I'd better report it. It's not like her.
Good morning, everyone. This is your captain, Captain Patey. One of the passengers, Miss Gay Gibson, appears to be missing. I'd be very grateful for information about her. Will anyone who has any information or has seen her recently please come forward? That is Miss Gay Gibson, a first-class passenger.
By 10:20 that morning, the captain knows she's not on board. Although no one has seen Gay Gibson since 1 o'clock the night before, one person does come forward, Steer, the steward. He admits that he had, in fact, recognised the man in the cabin. It was one of the deck stewards, James Cam, a good-looking, stocky 31-year-old. Although married, it seems Cam is far from faithful and unpopular for the way he was always boasting about his conquests. Nevertheless, Steer and Murray hadn't given him away to the officer of the watch, knowing if they'd done so, he would have been liable for dismissal. But now matters are more serious. Captain Patey orders Steer to say nothing to Cam, but sends for the deck steward himself. In the heat of the tropics, stewards usually wear singlets, but Cam arrives wearing his long-sleeved, high-necked jacket.
You asked to see me, sir?
Yes, Cam. You realise that as a deck steward it is no part of your duty to go into passengers' cabins?
Yes, sir.
You are suspected of being in cabin 126 at 3 o'clock this morning. Was it you?
No, sir. I wasn't near any passenger cabin after 12:45 when I locked up McPatrick.
Did you go straight to your quarters?
No, sir.
After I finished at approximately 1 a.m, I went forward to the well deck where I sat and smoked.
How long for?
Not long, sir. I began to feel sleepy, so I went to the toilet and retired. After that, I smoked a cigarette, and then I wound my clock. That was a little after 2 a.m.
And you didn't leave your cabin after that?
No, sir. Not until we were called at 5:45 a.m.
I see. Well, I'd like that in writing, Cam.
Yes, sir.
And would you have any objection to being medically examined?
Why, sir?
Well, you must realize that you are suspected over the disappearance of Miss Gibson. In your own defense, you should be examined.
Thank you, sir. Yes, sir. I will, sir.
You can go now.
Yes, sir. Why all this suspicion? Let's get down to bedrock.
Cam writes out a signed statement about his whereabouts on the fateful evening. He also writes and signs a second statement concerning his medical examination by the ship's doctor, Dr. Griffiths. It seems the doctor found scratches on his neck and arms. This was presumably the reason for his wearing the long-sleeved high-neck jacket. Cam attributes the scratches to the heat, prickly heat, which is common enough in the tropics. He says he's nearly scratched himself to death, and the marks on his neck, he says, are caused by rubbing with a rough towel. Cabin 126 is locked up, and Cam continues with his duties. At midnight on the 24th of October, the Durban Castle arrives at Cowes Roads, and Detective Sergeant Quinlan and other members of the Southampton Police come out to board her. Captain Patey hands over the keys of cabin 126 to Quinlan, and at 5:25, the detective meets Cam.
I've been making inquiries into the disappearance of a first-class passenger from this ship, a Miss Gibson.
Should I know anything about it?
I have reason to believe that you can assist me regarding my inquiries into this matter, Mr. Cam.
I knew Miss Gibson. I've seen her on deck and have attended to her.
Have you ever been in Miss Gibson's cabin?
Never.
What time did you finish working on Friday the 17th of this month? That would be the night before Miss Gibson disappeared.
About 1 o'clock in the morning.
I have good reason to believe that you can give me some further information regarding this matter. I also believe that you were in Miss Gibson's cabin at about 3 a.m. in the early hours of the 18th of October.
And that puts me into a tight spot.
Look, I'm not satisfied with your explanation, Cam. I've got to make further inquiries. Are you prepared to accompany me to police headquarters at Southampton?
They take him there and then return to the Durban Castle. There they interview the stewardess, Eileen Field, who tells detectives that she's seen Cam and Gay Gibson together on various occasions, and that Cam had mentioned to her that Miss Gibson had told him she was 3 months pregnant. Murray also told detectives how he'd heard Cam tell Miss Gibson he had a bone to pick with her on the night she went missing, the 17th, and how, though this was hardly a normal remark for a steward to make to a first-class passenger, she'd taken it in good part. At Southampton, Cam's story begins to crack. He admits that he saw her at 11:30 on the 18th in her cabin to ask her if she wanted some lemonade. This is with the rum that it seems he'd brought down earlier. Quinlan and Plumley are then joined by Detective Sergeant Gibbons when they next interview Cam.
Cam, I've been through the evidence and I have to tell you that you are in a serious position. Do you understand that?
What do you mean?
Well, let's review the circumstances and see what your position is.
How do you mean?
You have said you did not see Miss Gibson after 11:30 on the night of the 17th, 18th October. If it can be proved conclusively that not only were you in the cabin at 3 a.m, but she was there also, and that Miss Gibson disappeared while you were there, and there is scientific evidence that she did disappear through the porthole, you may find your complete denial rather difficult to explain.
Does that mean I murdered her and I'll be charged with murder?
At this stage, I can't say whether you'll be charged or not. But I'm sure you will realise that, particularly in the absence of a body, we have to give a particular care to any explanation you put forward. You may have a reasonable explanation for her death, but that will not be helped by your present complete denial.
You mean that Miss Gibson might have had a heart attack or something?
You must consider what explanation you want to make. Sergeant Quinlan?
Mr. Cam, you in the habit of visiting female passengers in their cabins?
Yeah. Some of them like us better than the passengers. I've been with them several times on other trips.
Was that at night?
Yeah. I've been with several. course, if I'd been found out, I would have got the sack.
I understand that you've been alleging that Miss Gibson was in a certain condition.
She gave me that inference.
How did she give you that inference?
She told me, said she was pregnant.
I've reason to believe that your story is untrue.
Well, that's what she told me.
I agree with Detective Sergeant Quinlan. Your answers to him seem to be inconsistent with the true story. It's been established that you were in the cabin at 3 o'clock.
Now, what'll happen about that, then?
My inquiries regarding this matter have been very extensive. And I have now arrived at the conclusion that you have not given me a true account of your movements that night.
There seems to be something in what you say.
Cam is cautioned, and Detective Constable Plumley begins to type. Cam tells how he returned to Gay Gibson's room at 2 o'clock, and that there, intimacy took place. But suddenly...
Miss Gibson clutched at me, foaming at the mouth. She was very still. I felt for her heartbeats, but couldn't find any. She was very still. I cannot offer any explanation as to how the bells for the steward and the stewardess came to be rung, as I most definitely did not touch them myself. Thinking she had fainted, I tried artificial respiration on her. Whilst doing this, the night watchman knocked at the door and attempted to open it. I shut the door again, saying it was all right. Then I panicked, as I thought he'd gone to the bridge to report to the officer of the watch. After a few minutes, I could find no sign of life. After a struggle with the limp body, by the way, she was still wearing her dressing gown, I managed to lift her up to the porthole and push her through. I'm fairly certain that at the time she was dead, but I was terribly frightened. I then went forward.
These were the events that led to James Cam being charged with the murder of Gay Gibson. He was formally charged at 1:30 on the afternoon of the 26th of October, 1947. When the case finally came to trial on the 18th of March, 1948, before Mr. Justice Hilbury at the Winchester Assizes, the defence could not attempt to deny these facts. The scratches, the pushing of the buttons to summon both steward and stewardess, and, above all, Cam's blatant lying. Both the Crown and the defence had very able counsel. Mr. J.D. Caswell, K.C. for the defence, Cam was granted legal aid, and Mr. G.D. Roberts, K.C. for the Crown. There's a folk belief, we might as well call it, that if no body can be found, murder can't be proved. But that isn't true. And though murder trials without a corpus delicti, as the lawyers put it, are not that common, there have been plenty of them. No, what happened off the African coast in October 1947 was curious for more reasons than just the lack of a body. Indeed, Mr. Roberts was able to argue that the very fact that there was no body, that Cam had admitted pushing Gay Gibson into the sea, strongly supported the prosecution's case.
Members of the jury, the prisoner, after 7 or 8 days of telling a different tale, put forward a defence. The defence that she died a natural death in his arms. Is there not one conclusive fact against that? The fact that the prisoner disposed of the body. If she died a natural death, what would have been easier for him than to have slipped unobserved from the cabin, as in fact he did? And then the next morning, this girl would have been found in her bed, sleeping her last sleep, having died a natural death. With what object did the prisoner push the lifeless body through the porthole? Can you imagine any other emotion which prompted this man to cast the body through the porthole except the emotion of fear? Cold fear. The fear of the murderer disposing of the body which would give deadly evidence against him? Or the fear of the ravisher whose advances have been rejected, disposing of the one witness who would give evidence against him?
Apart from the evidence of the ship's doctor, Dr. Griffiths, who'd seen the scratches on Cam's arm and neck when they were fresh and who denied they could have been self-inflicted, the medical evidence the prosecution could bring forward was fairly inconclusive, though the prosecution made as much of it as they could. The stains Miss Field had noticed on the bed linen were examined by Dr. Tier, a pathologist and lecturer in forensic medicine. Dried urine was found, which suggested that Gay Gibson had died on the bed and not in the sea. But it didn't prove she'd been murdered. The foaming at the mouth? Well, saliva and specks of blood were found, and this was consistent with strangulation, but equally consistent with the idea of a heart attack. But what about this idea of a heart attack? Cam was surely clutching at straws in suggesting that a healthy, fit 21-year-old should suddenly die this way. From 1943 to 1947, Gay Gibson had done her national service in the ATS, the Women's Auxiliary Territorial Service. While she was with them, she got involved in show business, acting with Ensa and appearing in Stars in Battle Dress. When she left the ATS, she was examined by a doctor, Ruth Haslam.
On 19 February 1947, I apparently examined number W315227, Private Eileen Isabella Ronnie Gibson.
Was there anything the matter with her?
According to the form I signed at the time, the only thing I found wrong with her was an old infection of the right ear. It had last discharged 3 weeks before. Her hearing was impaired. She had had a recent cold, but her general physical condition was good. I put her down as A1 non-tropical.
Dr. Haslam's opinion was confirmed by the next witness, Mrs. Eileen Victoria Gibson.
You are the mother of Eileen Gibson.
Yes, I am. I'm very proud to be the mother of Eileen Gibson.
Generally speaking, how was her health?
Excellent. She was one of the finest types of English womanhood, physically, mentally, morally.
You took her with you to South Africa, where your husband was?
Yes.
She took part in two theatrical productions there?
Yes. The Silver Cord and The Golden Boy.
During her time in South Africa, did you see any traces of ill health in her?
None whatever. Her health was excellent.
Under cross-examination, she did admit that Eileen, or according to her stage name, Gay, had been rather susceptible to colds and catarrh, but it hardly seemed very drastic. All in all, the bereaved mother, with her touching affection for her dead daughter and loyalty to her memory, made an impressive witness for the Crown. The various policemen and stewards and merchant marine officers also gave valuable evidence for the prosecution's case. Yet the witness who probably proved most valuable to the prosecution was one called by the defence, the prisoner himself, James Cam. In the witness box, he managed to appear callous and far too self-contained for one who claimed he'd panicked, and yet at the same time, he was muddled as to his facts. A liar, but a poor liar. In cross-examination, Roberts made the most of these faults.
Would you describe yourself as a truthful man?
I think so.
You put Miss Gibson through the porthole at 3 o'clock on the morning of the 18th of October.
Yes.
Did you not, for the next 8 days, make untrue statements with regard to that?
I did that, yes.
So what caused you to depart from the truth?
The predicament I found myself in. I was thinking only of myself.
Self-preservation, in fact. Why did you alter your story as a truthful man?
I realized I was definitely incriminated by the witness, Steer.
You told an untrue story until you felt it would not serve its purpose of saving you. Now, don't you call that curious conduct for a truthful person?
I should say it was beastly conduct.
Indeed. Now, those two bells in the cabin, who rang those bells?
I don't know.
What would you expect a passenger to do who in the night objected to the advances of a member of the crew?
Shout.
Not much good shouting. Isn't ringing the bells better?
They both amount to the same thing.
That is what she did, is it not?
She didn't touch the bell.
Are you suggesting the bells went off of their own accord?
I cannot suggest how the bells were rung.
And when the man came to the door, you slammed it in his face, even though, according to one of your stories, you thought the girl might be alive.
Yes.
Even though you took no steps to help her, though help was at hand.
No.
The trial took 4 days. Mr. Justice Hilbury summed up. He stressed the faults of Cam's character, the strength of the evidence against him, the scratches, the bells in particular, the health of Gay or Eileen Gibson, but above all, James Cam and his lies. It took the jury just 45 minutes to find Cam guilty. But Cam refused to admit his guilt, and the defence appealed, on the grounds that the judge's summing up was biased. They said he was unfair to the evidence brought by the defence. Eventually, the case did go to the appeal court. So what was it that they said the judge had overlooked? Who were the defence witnesses Mr. Justice Hilbury had apparently disregarded? One was Joan Armour, an ATS officer.
In early July 1946, I was notified one of the girls was ill in quarters. I went there and found Private Gibson. She was lying on her bed. Her back was arched and she was breathing very, very heavily. I went to help her, and as I helped her, she clutched herself at the chest and muttered pain. The condition lasted 10 to 15 minutes. It was very bad. When I thought I could safely leave her, I called an ambulance.
Not unlike Cam's description of what had happened. The next witness was Peter Dalby, who, as a member of ENSA, had toured England and Germany with Gay Gibson. He described her as excitable and neurotic, and told of several fits similar to those described by Joan Armour. Mrs. Gibson had said that her daughter was more interested in her career than men, except for one man. Mr. Cresswell asked Dalby about that one man.
Mrs. Gibson has told us her daughter was very fond of a man called Pierre.
That's right. He was a lorry driver, one of the scenery vehicles. They were infatuated with each other.
Did she have a burn on her hand?
The back of her hand. I'm not sure whether it was the left or the right. She had it as some sort of recognition of the driver, Pierre. But I'm not quite sure whether she or Pierre did it.
A somewhat different picture begins to emerge from that of Mrs. Gibson's healthy, best type of English womanhood. It's probable that Mrs. Gibson simply didn't know her daughter very well. The Gibsons worked and lived abroad. Their daughter was educated and did her national service in England. Mrs. Gibson disapproved of her theatrical career and her theatrical friends, as came out in Mr. Cresswell's cross-examination.
At Johannesburg, was she in a play produced by Mr. Gilbert?
Mr. Gilbert ran a little show in imitation of Tommy Handley at Broadcasting House, Johannesburg. She met him there. They were a different class of people from us.
Mr. Gilbert and his associates were a different class?
Yes. I advised her to take a refresher course in shorthand instead.
But she was in a play produced by Mr. Gilbert?
Yes. The only play he ever produced.
You don't seem very friendly to Mr. Gilbert.
No. Eileen said to me, Mother, Henry has turned out to be a rotter. On stage, he had to put his arm round her. She said, the way he mauls me on stage.
And there was a Dr. Shoeb, his wife. She befriended your daughter, did she not?
Never.
Did you know your daughter went to Dr. Shoeb for advice?
My daughter would go to a consultant for advice, not to Dr. Shoeb. She said she's a bit of a quack.
Did she tell you about a man called Mike Abel?
Yes. He had to play a gangster on stage. She said to me, Mother, I think he is a real gangster.
These were the three witnesses the defence had brought over from South Africa. Henry Gilbert, his wife, Dr. Shoeb, and Mike Abel.
Mr. Abel, did Miss Gibson tell you anything about herself?
Well, she told me she came to South Africa for her health and that her parents were killed by a V2 bomb.
Her health?
Asthma, she said she had.
Where were you when she told you these things?
In a car outside the doll's house. It's a sort of roadhouse.
Did anything happen while you were sitting there?
Yes, the late Miss Gibson seemed to lurch over. I noticed that in the corner of her mouth was white saliva.
Did you notice anything about her lips?
They were a bluish colour. I got a glass of water. The attack lasted 15 or 20 minutes.
Did you notice anything at rehearsals about her?
She was a charming girl, a very nice girl. But on occasions, for no rhyme or reason, she came up to me, kicked me, slapped my face, and then kissed me. One time at Mr. Gilbert's house, well, she'd been drinking quite a bit, she fainted in the garden.
Did she ever mention anything about her private affairs?
Once she asked me for £200 to get to England. She said she was pregnant. Well, I could not afford £200. That was very early after I met her. On another occasion, she caught my arm and said, Mike, I love you. Then she fainted away, like I described before.
Henry Gilbert's evidence endorsed what Mike Abel had said and went into some detail about his professional relationship with Gay Gibson. But the evidence of his wife, Dr. Shoeb, was a good deal more personal.
Did you do exercises with Miss Gibson on any occasion?
She asked me for advice on diet and exercises. I took her along to a physical culture course I was taking.
Did you notice anything about her during the exercises?
I noticed that she tired easily, became short of breath, and had to discontinue while I carried on. She told me she was suffering from asthma.
Did she tell you anything about herself of an intimate nature?
She told me she had had sexual experience. This was about the second time I'd met her. She said her period had not arrived and that she was worried that she was pregnant. I told her it was much too early to say. She was probably worried or excited about the show.
Did you have any discussion about a contraceptive?
When she told me about her period, I asked her if she had used a contraceptive during sexual experience. She looked blankly at me. She didn't seem to know anything about it. I advised her to have a device fitted.
Such a contraceptive was found in Miss Gibson's cabin. Naturally, since her sexual inexperience had become an important part of the prosecution's case, Mr. Roberts attacked the South African witnesses. And Mike Abel, with his dark glasses, leather gloves and tightly belted Macintosh, did look a bit of a gangster. On the other hand, why should these people lie to defend a man they'd never met? They all liked Gay, although they found her a bit naive, and the behaviour that they and other defence witnesses describe does seem credible. A middle-class girl from a sheltered background suddenly given her freedom. She falls passionately for a lorry driver, tells a man like Abel she loves him, and might well be attracted by a coarse, handsome man like James Cam. The evidence of the stewardess, Miss Field, and the steward, James Murray, suggested she was indeed on friendly terms with Mr. Cam. In addition, the boatswain's mate gave evidence that he saw her at 1 o'clock on the fatal night on the promenade deck, exactly where James Cam was likely to be. And the fact Cam was seen inside her cabin suggests she unbolted the door to him. Even so, what happened inside the cabin? In the trial, no less than 7 doctors were called as witnesses. Much the most distinguished was Professor Webster.
There is nothing in Cam's account inconsistent with my own experience with regard to the 3 deaths I have investigated of people who died in the course of sexual intercourse.
How might Miss Gibson's death have occurred by natural cause?
Several ways, all of which give rise to blood in the mouth, the terminal discharge of urine, and the scratching of the arm. But indirect heart disease is most common among younger people, namely the effect of a septic focus elsewhere in the body. And in this case, there was a septic focus, the chronic running year.
The professor's evidence was all the stronger because originally it had been requested by the prosecution. He said there was no evidence of rape or any violence, that Gay Gibson might well have had asthma, which made a heart attack more likely, and that the scratches on Cam's arm seemed to him to be too far up to have been inflicted by someone struggling for their life against a strangler. When the judge pressed as to whether the forensic evidence might have suggested strangulation, all Professor Webster would say is that he could not exclude that possibility. This, then, was the body of evidence that Mr. Justice Hilbury chose to dismiss and which led to the appeal. The appeal failed. Cam again was found guilty. Cam may well have murdered Miss Gibson in Cabin 126, but in English law, murder has to be proved beyond reasonable doubt. Perhaps it's just as well that, by a pure fluke, Cam escaped the gallows. It happened that when he was condemned, the abolition of hanging was under debate in Parliament. And though the bill failed, the Home Secretary ruled that anyone condemned during the debate should not die. James Cam was given life imprisonment. He was released after 11 years in 1959.
In Cabin 126, Graham Blockie played James Cam. Other parts were played by Timothy Bateson, Timothy Carlton, Tara Dominic, James Green, Ian Lindsay, Petra Markham, and Mark Straker. Murder Most Foul is written by John Scotney and presented by Nick Ross. The producer was Tim Souter.